Support for WPR comes from UW-Superior Center for Continuing Education, offering Conversations on Living Alone, a three-part series beginning Wednesday, April 17th via Zoom. Details at uwsuper.edu. Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy, committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
May is National Stroke Awareness Month, a time for health professionals to talk with the public about the signs and symptoms of strokes and encourage prevention in all forms. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. And have invited back a couple of guests, Dr. Luke Bradbury, stroke neurologist at UW Health. He specializes in a rapid evaluation and treating patients with acute strokes and stroke-like symptoms. Dr. Bradbury, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
And Chris Welly back with us as well, a registered nurse, stroke prevention, our stroke program coordinator at UW Health. And Chris, good to see you again.
Nice to see you too, Larry.
Here with me in the studio, and as always, we're welcoming your questions about strokes as well as your stories, so I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, email us at ideas@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Certainly love to hear from you. Dr. Bradbury, let's start out back to the basics here, because I think it... No matter how often we talk about it, it's always good to reinforce what a stroke is and what's happening to our bodies when a stroke occurs.
Absolutely. And that's one of the great things about Stroke Awareness Month is we get out and we talk about this a bunch to get it out there in the community so people know that when they have symptoms of a stroke that they go to the hospital right away. But essentially a stroke is really, there's two major categories of stroke. One is a bleeding type stroke. That's about 25% or so of all strokes where people have bleeding inside the skull, inside the brain, or around the brain. And then the other type is when there's interrupted blood flow. So either a clot travels to the brain and blocks blood flow to a part of the brain, or it's a local problem within the brain where a small blood vessel can kind of clot off and there's interrupted blood flow in that local region there. And those will cause immediate symptoms. Any of those can cause immediate symptoms where suddenly a patient will experience weakness, numbness, vision changes, trouble talking. And so there's this sort of phrase we have called BFAST, and that stands for B-E-F-A-S-T. B stands for balance. So sudden changes in balance. E is for eyes, changes in vision, double vision, blind spots. F for face. If you have weakness in your face, face droop or trouble, you know, sort of making your words. A is for arm. Mm-hmm. And that's where you have arm weakness on one side or the other. S is for speech. So if you have trouble slurring your words or trouble getting the right words out, you know what you want to say, but you can't get them out, or suddenly what people are saying to you sounds wrong, like a different language. And then T stands for time. That's time to call 911, get to the hospital as quickly as possible. Because the sooner you get to the hospital, the sooner we can hopefully treat this stroke and get someone better and help them recover faster than they would if they didn't go to the hospital right away.
Probably better to get somebody else to drive you if there's somebody there.
You know, we say, call 911. Yeah, because I've had patients where they're in an accident on the way to the hospital because they think they can drive, but it turns out they can't. Sometimes strokes, where the stroke is in the brain, it keeps you from recognizing how bad it is. And so you think you get in the car and you think you're fine, but in fact, either because of blind spots or you can't pay attention to one side of your world, you can actually cause a bad accident and hurt yourself and others. So we do say call 911. And there's another advantage to that is the excellent emergency medical provider out there in the ambulances, they know how to recognize a stroke. So when they pick someone up, they can get them in the ambulance and they call ahead. So they let us know, I'm bringing in a patient who has stroke symptoms, and we can get the emergency department ready to treat that patient as fast as we can. So
it's
a lot
of
good reasons. Yeah,
meet them at the door. And Chris, you're the stroke program coordinator at UW Health. Talk about there is a lot of coordination that goes on from the sound of listening to Dr. Bradbury there.
Right. Well, we coordinate our own internal operations to make sure everything is top quality. But during Stroke Month, one of the things we really try to focus on is making sure that people recognize the symptoms, as Dr. Bradbury said, and call 911. Fewer than 50% of people show up within an hour. Call 911 within an hour, and so don't get the treatment they need. So it's really important to
An hour or less is best.
Yes,
I would think.
Mm-hmm. Also, we're big on this holiday, mm-hmm. this awareness time. We're big on trying to make sure people understand the risk factors, of which high blood pressure is the number one risk factor and is really the silent killer.
Yeah. So let's say I'm on Memorial Weekend and I'm off to 100 miles from my hospital and I suffer a stroke.
911.
911. Just dial 911.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they will probably know the closest hospital to take you to get the best treatment. Now, that may be a small hospital, but if it's the closest one to you, they can maybe start treatment while they call a larger hospital like UW, for example. And they would talk to me on the phone and say, I have this patient and here are the symptoms. You know, what can we do now? And then we arrange for transfer here if necessary. So really, you know, getting to the closest hospital is really important so that they can start the treatment. And then they can also, you know, even if it's really far away, we can send the helicopter to pick up a patient, meaning that the transfer time is a lot faster than if you were to try and come all the way to Madison if you're far away.
Yeah, okay, so just hit 911. Mm-hmm. If that happens and you're away from home, a lot of people are going to be away from home in mm-hmm. over the next several months.
That's
so
right.
It's a good thing to know.
A couple other things we do to try and support people who have had strokes are stroke support group and stroke camp. So we have a stroke support group here in town. And there are actually several. We're very lucky in this community. We have four different support groups that run. And Stroke Camp, which is a once-a-year camp that people sign up to go to.
That's in the summer, isn't it? Or is it?
It is September 7th to the 9th.
Early fall, late summer. Mm-hmm. But that's a beautiful time to be going to a camp like that.
And it's really a hotel-type sleeping arrangements, but...
Yeah, wonderful. Well, Jill in New Berlin has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question as to whether symptoms of stroke can be more gradual. I have a more gradual onset. I have sort of a change in sensation around my eye. It feels like it would be swollen or droopy, but there is no visible sign of that. But I've had it for a while now. I've mentioned it to my GP and my optometrist, and they don't seem to think it's a concern, but it doesn't go away. So I'm just curious if you could have a more gradual onset of symptoms.
You know, generally for stroke, the rule of thumb that we use is that the symptoms would be very sudden and severe in onset. And that's because as the blood flow is interrupted to that part of the brain, it's a sudden symptom that someone can have. Now, like everything in medicine, there are exceptions to the rules. And so some people can have either stuttering symptoms or maybe a gradual symptom. But when we hear stories of slower symptoms that start kind of ramp up over time, it makes us think of other processes that can happen in the brain or the nervous system to cause numbness or weakness and things like that. So, you know, for example, the nerves that go to the face, sometimes the nerve itself can become damaged or have some trouble where you can develop numbness or weakness in your face. And so it could be something very different, but it's a good thing to get checked out. And hopefully the doctors that you've seen have kind of evaluated and you've done a thorough, you know, an investigation to these symptoms. So
I was trying to remember, and thanks again for calling, Joe. I was trying to remember there are times when you could have a very mild stroke mm-hmm. or something that...
Oh, a TIA? Is that what you're thinking of?
What is a TIA?
So a TIA stands for transient ischemic attack, and that is where there may be interruption of blood flow to the brain for a brief period of time, and then it's restored, and there's no damage left. So you can become symptomatic while that blood is blocked, the blood flow is blocked, and then once it restores, there's no damage done, and there's a complete recovery. There is an old term that used to be used called mini stroke, and we tend not to use that term anymore, because when I use the word stroke, what I mean is that there's permanent damage in the brain that was done. Mm-hmm. And so when we say TIA, or transient ischemic attack, it's the stroke process, but luckily blood flow is restored and there was no damage done.
But even when you recover from that, you need to go to the hospital. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Because another way to think of it is it's like a warning for a stroke. So in other words, there's a risk of having a stroke that led to the TIA. We want to get the patient, we want to try and find those risk factors that they might have and make them as small as possible.
It's your best opportunity not to have a stroke. Mm-hmm.
Joe in Appleton, let's take a call from you now. Thank you for calling.
Yes, I heard Chris mention stroke camp, and I wanted to call and comment on what a benefit that is for somebody to try that. For a stroke survivor, I am a stroke survivor, and I've been to a stroke camp several times.
And what's great about it?
I guess it's an opportunity to get with other survivors and see how they're coping with their situation. The overcoming a stroke, for me anyway, was very difficult emotionally.
Yeah.
And to talk with others who've been through similar activities really inspired me and changed my outlook on life.
Oh, that's wonderful, Joe. Thank you. A comment, Mary? Or Chris, I'm sorry.
Joe, you've inspired a lot of other people, too. Joe also was at our very first stroke camp, and then he even started a group of stroke camps himself up north.
Oh, that's great. How do you sign up for those, by the way, Chris?
You can go to strokecamp.org, the website, or you can call 309-688-5450. And they can sign you up. There are only six slots left, but it's for stroke survivors and their partner.
All right. Thank you again, Joe, for calling. Chris in Green Bay, your turn.
My dad. Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. My dad had a series of strokes throughout his life. I guess they were called mild or mini, but I learned today it's something called the GIA. Probably. When he was younger, like in his 30s, he fully recovered in like a month or so. In his later years in life, the doctors said they probably had between 30 or 50 strokes. Now, a few weeks ago, my oldest son, who's in college, had blurry vision and loss of had numbness on his left-hand side. I'm wondering if this is a genetic thing that I should have him check out by a neurologist, or he did recover fully.
Yeah.
It's a great idea to have them get checked out. There are a few things that can run in families that can lead to stroke. Sometimes, when you have disorders of artery formation or cardiac problems that can increase the risk of stroke, they can run in families. But even if it weren't for your father's history, if I heard that story in your son, I'd want him to get checked out and have the sort of routine stroke workup so that we can make sure if there is a risk factor that you can address and make lower, we do it.
And we can talk about some of the procedures that Dr. Bradbury was mentioning in just a few minutes, as a matter of fact. Dr. Luke Bradbury, stroke neurologist at UW Hospitals. Chris Welly, registered nurse, stroke program coordinator for UW Health. And they're going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. We are right in the middle of National Stroke Awareness Month and taking some time today to talk about stroke prevention, treatment, and a whole lot more with our two guests. I'm Larry Mueller, our guest Dr. Luke Bradbury, stroke neurologist at UW Health. Chris Welly is a registered nurse and the stroke program coordinator at UW Health. As always, join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. You could also tweet at L. Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And a couple callers have been waiting a bit to get in. Let's go to Christina in Glenwood City next. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you so much for this important topic. I am wondering, is there any advantage to chewing, say, 325 milligrams of aspirin while you're waiting for the EMTs to arrive or on the way to the ER?
Dr. Bradbury?
Excellent question that we get from time to time. And it's a little bit different than what they would recommend, for example, for a heart attack. I said at the beginning that about 25% of strokes are bleeding type strokes. And if you were to take extra aspirin when you're having a bleeding type stroke, it could make it actually worse. And so for stroke symptoms, we recommend not taking aspirin, instead coming to the hospital right away so we can do a brain scan. One of the first things that happens when you have a stroke symptom and you end up in the emergency department is we do a quick brain scan to look for bleeding. And if there's no bleeding, then we may give medication to help break up a blood clot. If we can't give those, we often give aspirin at that time. So it's a great thought because we're thinking most of the time it is a blood clot problem, but the fact is it can be a bleeding problem, and so we recommend not taking aspirin if you're having stroke symptoms.
Thanks very much, Christina, for calling. Dan in Stoughton, it's your turn.
Yes, I've worked with Stroke Camp for quite a few years with Chris and Dr. Bradbury, and one of the things that I've seen happen there is really about the caregiver. Of course, there's a extreme value for all the stroke survivors who are there, and as Joe mentioned and other people on the phone, it's really valuable, but it may be even more valuable for the caregivers who don't get a chance really to say the things or talk about the things that are close to their heart or their emotions. They need to talk to other caregivers as well. And Stroke Camp gives them a great opportunity for that. I remember one person saying at camp that they hadn't really been more than 10 feet away from their stroke survivor that they were caring for in many years. And that just kind of struck me that's their life. So I thought maybe Chris or someone wanted to talk about the caregivers a little bit.
Yeah, Chris, a comment on that?
Yeah, definitely the caregivers really get a lot out of Stroke Camp. They quickly feel that the volunteers are trustworthy, and they feel comfortable separating themselves from their stroke survivor. You know, we break into little groups, and they form such strong bonds over being able to talk to someone else about what's going on. And a lot of times they learn a lot from each other, you know, and there is a lot of learning that goes on about different things that you can do depending on symptoms.
Dan, thank you so much for calling. Ruth in Dubuque, Iowa, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Ruth, are you there?
Yes. My husband and I are not overweight. We exercise regularly. Does that mean we have a lesser chance of having a stroke?
All right. Here's Ruth. She exercises, not overweight, neither is her husband. Does that help in terms of avoiding a stroke?
It absolutely does. And so one of the things, you know, we talk a lot about medicines and we talk a lot about treatments that we can do. But one of the biggest things that people can do is exactly what Ruth is doing, where we can make lifestyle modifications, as we say, in order to lower your risk of stroke. And so the guideline recommendations for exercise are to get about half an hour or so of moderate to vigorous exercise activity, you know, around 3 or 4 times a week. And that clearly reduces the risk of stroke. So it's excellent that that's what you're doing. Of course, eating a healthy diet. And what I always tell people is if you want to look up the Mediterranean diet online, is very close to the guideline recommendations for what we call the DASH diet, are also very good for preventing strokes and help reduce that risk of having a stroke. So those kinds of lifestyle modifications are excellent to make. And it should. I mean, if Ruth and her husband are exercising regularly and watching their weight, that should absolutely reduce the risk of having a stroke.
And people can just walk. I mean, there are a lot of, I mean, there's benefit to walking for people who are sedentary. So the most important thing is if you sit at a desk all day, get up every hour, take a walk, you know, make sure that you're moving all day long. And also about diet, I think it's a real simple thing to do is cut down on fast foods. Fast foods are full of sodium and fat. So
that's a risk. I mean, let's talk about the risk factors. I mean, we kind of talked about some of them, but maybe it's worth going over some more of those risk factors that.
Yeah. And so blood pressure, high blood pressure is the number one probably effect that people can, if they have that as a diagnosis, that can increase their risk of strokes and heart attacks and other problems too. And so getting high blood pressure treated is really important. Now that can happen with physical activity and changing your diet and making some of those lifestyle modifications, but sometimes it does require a medication. And so that's why it's important to keep up with your primary doctor, make sure they check your blood pressure. And if it's high, to maybe take a medication to lower that, because that will significantly reduce their risk of stroke. And another one very similar to that is high cholesterol. That's another risk factor that people have. You get screened for that. You see your primary doctor, and there's recommendations for how often that should happen. And if it is high, again, those lifestyle modifications can make a difference. But if they can't help enough, then taking a medicine to help lower cholesterol will also reduce your stroke risk. So those are two of the important ones that people can address and make better.
And smoking. Stop smoking. Don't start. Even secondhand smoke will increase your risk. Mm-hmm. So avoid smoking it.
We have sort of on the negative side, I guess, or the sad side, is there's been somewhat of a reversal of some of the good trends we had going, I believe, in stroke prevention.
That's right. The last couple of years, we've had some problems. So back in 2000, one of the ways to measure health metrics is to look at how many things happen per 100,000 people out in the community there. And the stroke deaths in the year 2000 were almost 120 per 100,000 of the population there. But by the time 2013 rolled around, we were down to about 70. So we went from 120 down to 70. So a big improvement in, big reduction in the deaths from stroke in America. But after about 2013 or so, we've seen, especially in some states, but really even across the board all over America, an unfortunate increase in that again. And the incidence of stroke is going up. And sometimes it's, there's a couple of reasons for it. One is that younger people are experiencing more strokes.
Oh.
Because some of the things we just spoke about, you know, when we talk about high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, inactivity, those are more prevalent in younger people. And as those people get a little bit older, then we start to see them having strokes. And then, of course, the other thing is the baby boomer generation is aging into their stroke years, where the incidence of stroke goes up. So unfortunately, we have seen this kind of reversal in some very positive trends. And that's one of the great things about Stroke Month is we talk about the risk factors for stroke. We talk about how people can improve that. And we hope that we'll start to see that reverse again with enough planning.
Sure hope so. Mm-hmm. Let's take some more calls. You can join in again at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We'll go to Pat in Milwaukee next. Hi, Pat.
Thanks, Larry. I'm a senior who is a poor senior, and I would be resistant just to even at the thought of calling an ambulance, which would probably cost more than my monthly Social Security check. And the whole idea, the angst of seeking health care creates a lot of fear, and I'm wondering how you address the resistance of those of us who aren't adequately insured. Now, I have Medicare, but I don't have a supplemental because I can't afford it. So, you know, what words of advice do you have for us?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that is a huge problem that we deal with, you know, really every day. And access to healthcare and the cost of healthcare is a huge burden that a lot of people have to deal with. Now, for stroke, you know, it's really hard because I've had patients where they come into the emergency department, they've had mild symptoms, and it turns out not to be a stroke. It's something very benign. But we didn't know that until they got to the emergency department. And so you can look back in hindsight and say, well, yes, that was a big expense. Even just going to the emergency department and leaving from there, not getting admitted to the hospital and not having all these tests done is still a very expensive endeavor. And I wish there was a better way. But unfortunately, the reality is even minor strokes that or symptoms that start minor can progress to more severe symptoms if they're untreated and those risk factors aren't addressed. So I have to recommend that people still, even, you know, despite you know, trouble with finances and knowing that it's going to be an expensive trip, need to call 911 and go to the hospital if you're experiencing a stroke. But, you know, on the other side of that, I would say this is another source for, you know, I would say activism, getting out, talking to your representatives and talking to community leaders about access to healthcare and the problems that people have. And I don't want anyone to feel that they need to stay at home because they can't afford the care that they really need. It's a big problem.
Yeah. And the other side of it is if you get to the hospital in time and then you can reverse your stroke. And if you don't get there in time, we might not be able to help you and you could be disabled and end up in a nursing home, which is a very expensive end point.
And again, the most cost-effective way to treat a stroke is to not have it in the first place. And so, you know, even before that, keeping up with your doctor, getting those risk factors looked at and making sure that we treat them ahead of time so that we don't have that stroke is so important, too. So remember that as well.
Thank you, Pat, for calling. Vern in Stanley, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Vern.
Hi. Good. I didn't think I'd get on the radio.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. What's on your mind?
Okay. I was in the Air Force, and I used to get these really terrible headaches. And, you know, VA, we've been around the block, and it's caused by potassium nitrate. But at any rate, what happens, and after all my research, I'm 75 years old, is you get high blood pressure in the brain and cause a thing called cluster headache. And I don't know if you heard of it. It's a very painful headache. So finally, I got some high blood pressure medication. First, I started with Atacan. He had an angiotensin 2 blocker, and then I went on Losartan, and it reduced the headache like 90%. But my blood pressure was like a seesaw. So what they need to do is test you for angiotensin II levels before you say from every so often fire, maybe from the age of 20. But when they take your blood pressure, they need to take it when you're standing up, sit down, then you do 2 minutes of exercise, then you sit down and they take it so that you get a more accurate reading, because they normally have you sit there for half an hour and they take it when you're sitting down, so they really don't get an accurate reading and your high blood pressure goes undetected. But mine would vary. I had like 82 over 40, and then it would go up into 120 over 80, where it would be almost normal. But then it went
Somewhere else, yeah. Dr. Bradbury?
Yeah, you know, Vern brings up cluster headaches are some of the most painful things that people can experience, and I'm glad they're under better control now. I think what, you know, hearing Vern's story, what I think of is we have these recommendations, these guidelines that we follow, but really at the heart of it, when you're with your doctor, you know, treating that individual patient, you know, is one of my goals and making sure that we do what's right for them. And so Vern had his blood pressure had a different maybe sort of path that it took than other people with high blood pressure, and the medications may be very different for Vern than someone else. And so it's always good to get that good relationship with your primary doctor, talk to them, make sure that they know you well and that they treat you as needed to be treated, and you know, we're not just following these guidelines blindly, but we know the patient.
I've actually seen some research recently on people that it's always assumed, well, your blood pressure is going to be a little higher when you go in to see the doctor. In a lot of cases, that's not necessarily. It may be that it's higher under a whole lot of other circumstances when you're not in the doctor's office.
When there's that thing called white coat hypertension is what they call that, where you go to the doctor and your blood pressure is high when they measure it in the office. But, you know, people who have that probably do, you know, if you get cut off in traffic or something bothers you, you know, then your blood pressure may jump up there too. It's always one thing I like to have my patients do if we're worried about blood pressure and knowing exactly what it is most of the time is you can get blood pressure cuffs to have at home and check it on a regular basis. So you know what it is when you're relaxed and you're sitting down, when you're standing up after you've had some physical activity. And bringing in all of that information really helps me make a good decision about which medication to adjust. Do you need a new one? Is it just occasionally, you know, mildly high and that's nothing to worry about? So it doing that monitoring at home can be very helpful for your doctor.
Let's turn to River Falls next and talk with Jill. Jill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. My question has to do with the medication that can be used after a stroke to actually stop the impact. And so my question is, how soon after a stroke do you need to take those medications? And then how long after a stroke can you still be administered those medications at the emergency room?
So the medication that we give, and this is really the only FDA-approved medication for acute stroke treatment, is called TPA, which stands for tissue plasminogen activator, or Alteplase is the brand name for that. And that should be in most emergency departments across the United States. And if you show up there, that's the medicine that we try and decide, can we give it safely or not? And the when the studies were originally done, there was a three-hour time window. And this is from when you were last normal. So when you're last in your neurological normal state until when they're able to give that medicine should be within 3 hours is the FDA approval. There are a lot of hospitals now that will extend that time window out to 4.5 hours so that, in the right circumstances, it seems to be safe to give out to 4.5 hours. So that's kind of the hard stop after that is after 4.5 hours, we don't feel comfortable giving that medicine because the bleeding risk may be higher than the potential benefit that you could get from the improving the stroke. Now, that's to say that it isn't like, I want to be sure that everyone understands that doesn't mean you can wait until that time window.
Yeah.
You know, the sooner you get treated, the better the chance of having your stroke symptoms improve. And so it's not just that there's a deadline, but in fact, if you can get it treated at 1 hour versus 2 hours, that 1 hour time window is a lot better as far as the efficacy of the medicine. So it's in a sense, you know, there is a deadline of when we can't give it, but the sooner we can give it, the better the chance of improving symptoms.
And it does take some time once you get to the hospital to do tests and things to make sure that we can give it to you to screen you. Mm-hmm. Also, now people can, it used to be that when you had a wake up stroke, so somebody wakes up with a stroke, then their last known well is when they went to bed, and that's a problem. And now we have Some things we can do for that. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
There's a lot of new imaging abilities that we have. So in the not long ago, all we could really do is a CT scan of the head to look for bleeding. Now we have what we call multimodal CT imaging, where we can do a bunch of different scans using contrast and different methods of manipulating the machine to where we can see the blood flow through the brain, which is really helpful. And we can look at the arteries very closely to look for blockages. And that's especially helpful. So if a patient, they may or may not be able to get that medicine, but sometimes if we see a large blockage, we can actually have our surgeons go in and pull that blood clot out and restore blood flow that way. So that's a very, you know, exciting thing that we've been able to do for several years now and has really had a big impact on patients' ability to recover quickly from their strokes.
Oh, very interesting. And Jill, thanks again for your call. Let's go to Rick and Prentice next. Hi, Rick.
Hi, I'm a 73-year-old farmer, and I had a slight stroke. The doctor said it was a slight stroke anyway. I first went to Park Falls, and the doctor didn't think I had a stroke at all. But then the symptoms continued, and I went to the Marshfield Clinic, and they detected a small stroke. The only symptoms I have are I'm really tired most of the time. I'm still doing my work, but doing a lot slower. And I can't run at all. I can't jog or anything like that. And I'm wondering if there's anything I can do, or am I going to be this way for the rest of my time?
Yeah. How long ago did you have your stroke?
I was 71. It was about 2 years ago.
2 years ago. So, you know, one of the big challenges that we have with stroke recovery are when people experience what you have is called, fatigue after their stroke, post-stroke fatigue. A lot of people also complain of memory problems and some trouble thinking as sharply as they used to. These are things that, you know, we try and work on with therapy, but the reality is a lot of times we just have to give it time. We don't have great medicines that can reverse the fatigue part of the stroke. And even like you're describing small strokes in, you know, parts of the brain that I wouldn't expect to cause a lot of fatigue, you know, they do. And the best recommendation I can give you is just to keep on trying, keep on pushing forward, be as active as you can. But I unfortunately do have patients that suffer from long-term fatigue. But I have a lot of patients where even years after their stroke, they do experience improvement. So they do think that things are getting better. It may not be as quickly as right after the stroke, but they do come back to me year after year saying that things are getting a little bit better, you know, every time I see them. So I hope it does. But other than just being active, being healthy, taking the medicines for stroke prevention that you've been prescribed, those are the best things you can do.
What's the reason that you can't run? Is it because coordination?
I've kind of lost my balance a little bit. I just can't do it anymore. I used to be able to jog, but I can't jog more than a few steps now.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes when we talk about an exercise regimen, it's great to have a good physical therapist help you set that up, because a lot of my patients have deficits, whether it's weakness or numbness, coordination problems, where they can't exercise like they used to. And so having a good physical therapist set up a good exercise program with you can be really helpful to get that activity in, improve that fatigue, even though you may not be able to do exactly what you did before your stroke.
The UW also has a fitness program for people who need that kind of help that's available.
And if you like to run and you can't, you're having trouble with that, I really like your advice about seeing a physical therapist. Just getting out and walking is also, I think you were talking about that earlier, Chris, some activity is
better than none.
Is better than no activity. But there's still hope there for you, Rick, the way it sounds. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And I want to just go back for a minute. There aren't too many spots left in stroke camp, but how do people get involved in that again?
Yes. So if you'd like to get involved in stroke camp, go to strokecamp.org or call 309-688-5450. We have a few spots left for new people, and we'd love to have you join us.
And again, for more information on strokes, the UW site has some information, or where's the best place to go?
The UW site, our Comprehensive Stroke Center, has some great information on there. I also, you know, I think if you're looking for general information about stroke causes and things, the CDC has a great website that gives you very good, you know, well-researched, solid information. My colleagues at the Mayo Clinic have some great sites set up also to describe things.
So uwstroke.org, the American Stroke Association, or nationalstrokeassociation.org.
There we go. Dr. Luke Bradbury from the UW Health, a stroke neurologist. Chris Welly, registered nurse and the stroke program coordinator. I expect they'll be back. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store.